Oh my God. I shoved his shoulder and flopped back into my seat, laughing. Are you slightly misquoting A Walk to Remember at me? Gus cracked another smile. Excellent movie, he said. Sorry, film. I rolled my eyes, still shivering with laughter. A half laugh rattled out of him, too. I'm serious. I think I got to second base in the theater during that one. I refuse to believe anyone would cheapen the greatest love story involving Mandy Moore ever told by letting a teenage Gus Everett cop a feel. Believe whatever you want, January Andrews, he said. Jack Reacher risks his life every day to guarantee you that freedom. Chapter 9. The Manuscript. When I woke, I did not have a hangover, but I did have a text from Shoddy reading, "He has a whole rack of vintage hats." "And how would you know that?" I texted back. I climbed off the couch and went into the kitchen. While I still hadn't gathered enough courage to go upstairs or even start sleeping in the downstairs guest bedroom, I'd started to find my way around the cupboards. I knew the rose-speckled kettle was already on the burner, that there was no coffee maker in the kitchen, and that there was a French press and grinder down in the Lazy Susan. This, I had to assume, was one of Sonia's contributions, because I'd never seen Dad drink anything but the Starbucks Keurig cups Mom bought in bulk, or the green tea she begged him to have instead. I wasn't a coffee snob myself. I could get behind flavored syrups and whipped toppings, but I started most mornings with something drinkable enough to have it black. I filled the kettle and turned the burner on, that warm, earthy smell of gas leaping to life with the flame. I plugged the grinder in and stared out the window as it worked. Last night's mist had held out, cloaking the strip of woods between the house and the beach in deep grays and blues. The house had chilled too. I shivered, pulling my robe tighter. As I waited for the coffee to steep, my phone vibrated against the counter. "Well," Shoddy began. "A bunch of us went out after work, and as usual, he was totally ignoring me except whenever I wasn't looking, and then I could feel him just absolutely staring at me. So eventually he went to the bathroom, and I also had to go, so I was back in the hallway waiting, and then he came out and was like, 'Hey, Shod,' and I was like, 'Wow, I honestly thought you didn't speak until this moment,' and he just like shrugged. So I was like, 'Anyway, I was thinking about leaving.' And he was like, 'Oh shit, really?' And he was just like obviously disappointed. And then I was like, 'Well, I was thinking about leaving with you.' And he was so nervous and like excited, like, 'Yeah, that sounds good. When do you want to go?' And I was like, 'Duh, now.' And as you can see, the rest is history." "Wow," I typed back. "It's a tale as old as time." "Truly," Shoddy responded. "Girl meets boy, boy ignores girl except when she's not looking, girl goes home with boy and sees him hang his haunted hat on a crowded rack." The timer went off, and I pressed the coffee and poured some into a mug shaped like a cartoonish orca whale, then took it and my computer out onto the deck, mist pleasantly chilling every bare inch of my skin. I curled up in one of the chairs and started to make a mental checklist for the day and for the rest of the summer. First and foremost, I needed to figure out where exactly this book was going, if not in the direction of a feel-good summer romance with a single father. Then I needed to plan out Saturday's romantic comedy scenario for Gus. My stomach flipped at the thought. I'd half expected to wake up in a panic about our agreement. Instead, I was excited. For the first time in years, I was going to write a book that absolutely no one was waiting for. And I'd get to watch Gus Everett try to write a love story. Or I was going to make a huge fool of myself and, far worse, disappoint Anya. But I couldn't think about that right now. There was work to do. Aside from working on the book and scheduling the actual only Uber driver to take me to get my car from Pete's, I decided I'd conquer the second upstairs bedroom today and divide whatever was in there into throwaway, giveaway, and sell piles. I also vowed to move my stuff into the downstairs bedroom. I'd done okay on the couch the first few nights, but had awoken this morning to some serious kinks in my neck. My gaze wandered toward the swath of windows along the back of Gus's house. At that precise moment, he walked into his kitchen, pulling a, shocker, rumpled, dark t-shirt over his head. I spun back in my deck chair. He couldn't have seen me watching him. But the more I thought about it, the more I worried that I might have stared for a couple of seconds before looking away. I could vividly picture the curves of Gus's arms as he tugged the shirt over his head, a flat length of stomach framed by the sharp angles of hip bones. He was a little softer than he'd been in college. Not that it took much, but it suited him. Or maybe it just suited me. Well, I had definitely stared. I glanced back quickly and started. Gus was standing in front of the glass doors now. He lifted his mug as if to toast me. I lifted mine in response, and he shuffled away. If Gus Everett was getting to work already, I also needed to. I opened my computer and stared at the document I'd been picking at for the last few days. A meet cute. There weren't meet cutes in Augustus Everett novels, that was for damn sure. What was there? I hadn't read either of them, not Rochambeau and not The Revelatories, but I'd read enough reviews of them to satiate my curiosity. People doing the wrong thing for the right reasons. People doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. Only getting what they wanted if it would ultimately destroy them. Twisted, secretive families. Well, I had no experience there. The ache shot through me. It felt like the first few seconds of a burn, when you couldn't tell whether it was heat or cold burrowing into your skin, but knew either way it would leave damage. The memory of my fight with Mom after the funeral rose up like a tidal wave. Jacques had left for the airport the second the service was over to make it back for work, missing the showdown with Sonia entirely, and once she'd fled, Mom and I didn't stick around for long either. We fought the whole drive back to the house. No, that wasn't true. I fought. Years worth of feelings I'd chosen not to feel. Years of betrayal forcing them out. How could you keep this from me? I'd shouted as I drove. She wasn't supposed to come here, Mom had said, then buried her face in her hands. I can't talk about this, she'd sobbed, shaking her head. I can't. From then on, anything else I said was answered with this. I can't talk about this. I can't talk about him like this. I'm not going to talk about it. I can't. I should have understood. I should have cared more what Mom was feeling. This was meant to be the moment that I became the adult, hugging her tight, promising everything would be okay, taking her pain. That's what grown daughters did for their mothers. But back in the church, I'd torn in half, and everything had spilled out of me into plain view for the first time. Hundreds of nights I'd chosen not to cry. Thousands of moments I'd worried about worrying that if I did it, I'd make things worse for my parents, that I needed to be strong, that I needed to be happy so I wouldn't drag them down. All those years when I was terrified my mother would die, I'd tucked every ugly thing out of sight to transform my life into a shiny window display for her benefit. I'd made my parents laugh. I'd made them proud. I'd brought home solid grades, fought tooth and nail to keep up with Gus Everett. I'd stayed up late reading with Dad and gotten up early to pretend I liked yoga with Mom. I'd told them about my life. Asked them endlessly about theirs so I'd never regret wasting time with them, and I hid the complicated feelings that came with trying to memorize someone you loved just in case. I fell in love at 22, just like they had, with a boy named Jacques, who was the singularly most beloved and interesting person I'd met, and I paraded our happiness past them as often as I could. I gave up on grad school to be close to them, but proved I hadn't really missed out on anything by publishing at 25. Look, I'm fine. Look, I have every beautiful thing you wanted from me. Look, this hasn't affected me at all. Look, they all live happily ever after. Again. I'd done everything I could to prove that I was okay, that I wasn't worrying. I did everything I could for that story. The one where the three of us were unbreakable. On the drive home from the funeral, I didn't want to be okay anymore. I wanted to be a kid. I wanted to scream, to slam doors, to yell, "I hate you! You're ruining my life!" like I never had. I wanted Mom to ground me, then sneak into my room later and kiss my forehead, whisper, "I understand how scared you are." Instead, she wiped away her tears, took a deep breath, and repeated, "I'm not going to talk about this." "Fine," I said, defeated, broken. "We won't talk about it." When I flew back to New York, everything changed. Mom's calls became rare, and even when they did happen, they hit like a tornado. She'd cyclone through every detail of her week, then ask how I was doing, and if I hesitated too long, she'd panic and excuse herself for some exercise class she'd forgotten about. She'd spent years preparing for her own death without any time to brace herself for this. For him to leave us, and for the ugly truth to walk into his funeral and tear all our pretty memories in half. She was in pain. I knew that. But I was in pain too. So much of it that for once I couldn't laugh or dance any measure of it away. I couldn't even write myself a happy ending. I didn't want to sit here in front of my laptop outside this house full of secrets and exercise my father's memory from my heart. But apparently, I'd found the one thing I could do, because I'd already started typing. The first time she met the love of her father's life was at his funeral. My love affair with romance novels had started in the waiting room of my mother's radiologist's office. Mom didn't like for me to go in with her. She insisted it made her feel senile. So I'd sat with a well-worn paperback from the rack, trying to distract myself from the ominous ticking of the clock fixed over the sign-in window. I'd expected to stare at one page for 20 minutes, caught in the hamster wheel of anxiety. Instead, I'd read 150 pages and then accidentally stuffed the book in my purse when it was time to go home. It was the first wave of relief I'd felt in weeks, and from there, I binge-read every romance novel I could get my hands on. And then, without any true plans, I started writing one. And that feeling of falling head over heels in love with a story and its characters as they sprang out of me was unlike anything else. Mom's first diagnosis taught me that love was an escape rope, but it was her second diagnosis that taught me love could be a life vest when you were drowning. The more I worked on my love story, the less powerless I felt in the world. I may have had to ditch my plan to go to grad school and find a teaching job, but I could still help people. I could give them something good, something funny and hopeful. It worked. For years, I had a purpose, something good to focus on. But when Dad died, suddenly writing, the one thing that had always put me at ease, a verb that felt more like a place only for me, the thing that had freed me from my darkest moments and brought hope into my chest in my heart's heaviest, had seemed impossible. Until now. And, okay, this was more of a diary written in third person than a novel, but words were coming out of my hands, and it had been so long since that had happened, I would have rejoiced to find "all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy" filling up the Word document 1,000 times over. This had to be better than that. She had no idea whether her father had actually loved that woman. She didn't know whether he'd loved her mother either. The three things she knew without doubt that he'd loved were books, boats, and January. It wasn't just that I'd been born then. He'd always acted like I'd been born in January because it was the best month, and not the other way around. In Ohio, I'd largely considered it to be the worst month of the year. Oftentimes, we didn't get snow until February, which meant January was just a gray, cold, lightless time when you no longer had a major holiday to look forward to.
In West Michigan, it's different, Dad had always said. There was the lake and the way it would freeze over, covered in feet of snow.
Apparently, you could walk across it like it was some Martian tundra. In college, Shadi and I had planned to drive out one weekend and see it, but she'd gotten a call that their Sheltie had died, and we'd spent the weekend watching Masterpiece Classic and making s'mores on the stovetop instead. I got back to typing. If things had been different, she might have gone to the lakeside town in winter instead of summer, sat behind the wall of windows staring at the white-capped blues and strange frozen greens of the snowy beach. But she'd had this uncanny feeling, a fear she'd come face to face with his ghost if she'd shown up there at just the right time.
I would have seen him everywhere. I would have wondered how he'd felt about every detail, remembered a particular snowfall he'd described from his childhood. All these tiny orbs, January, like the whole world was made out of Dippin' Dots. Pure sugar.
He'd had a way of describing things. When Mom read my first book, she told me she could see him in it, in the way I wrote. It made sense. I'd learned to love stories from him, after all. She used to pride herself on all the things she had in common with him, regard the similarities with affection. Night owls, messy, always late, always carrying a book. Careless about sunblock and addicted to every form of potatoes. Alive when we were on the water. Arms thrown wide, jackets rustling, eyes squinting into the sun. Now she worried those similarities betrayed the terrible wrongness that lived in her. Maybe she, like her father, was incapable of the love she'd spent her life chasing. Or maybe that love simply didn't exist. Chapter 10. The Interview. I'd read somewhere that it took 10,000 hours to be an expert at something. Writing was different, too vague a something for 10,000 hours to add up to much. Maybe 10,000 hours of lying in an empty bathtub brainstorming added up to being an expert on brainstorming in an empty bathtub. Maybe 10,000 hours of walking your neighbor's dog, working out a plot problem under your breath, would turn you into a pro at puzzling through plot tangles. But those things were parts of a whole. I'd probably spent more than 10,000 hours typing novels, those published as well as those cast aside, and I still wasn't an expert at typing, let alone an expert on writing books. Because even when you'd spent 10,000 hours writing feel-good fiction and another 10,000 reading it, it didn't make you an expert at writing any other kind of book. I didn't know what I was doing. I couldn't be sure I was doing anything. There was a decent chance I'd send this draft to Anya and get an email back like, "Why did you just send me the menu for Red Lobster?" But whether or not I was actually succeeding at this book, I was writing it. It came in painful ebbs and desperate flows, as if timed to the waves crashing somewhere behind that wall of fog. It wasn't my life, but it was close. The conversation between the three women, Ellie, her mother, and Sonia's stand-in Lucy, might have been word for word, although I knew not to trust memory quite so much these days. If memory were accurate, then Dad couldn't have been here, in this house, when Mom's cancer came back. He couldn't have been, because, until he died, I had memories of them dancing barefoot in the kitchen, of him smoothing her hair and kissing her head, driving her to the hospital with me in the back seat and the playlist he'd enlisted me to help him piece together playing on the car stereo. Willie Nelson's Always on My Mind. Mom and Dad's hands clasped tightly on the center console. Of course, I remembered the business trips too, but that was the point. I remembered things as I'd thought they'd been, and then the truth, that truth, had ripped the memories in half as easily as if they had been images on printer paper. The next 3 days were a fervor of writing, cleaning, and little else. Aside from a box of wrapping paper, a handful of board games, and a great deal of towels and spare bedding, there was nothing remotely personal in the upstairs guest bedroom. It could have been any vacation home in America, or maybe a model home, a half-assed promise that your life, too, could be this kind of generically pretty. I liked the upstairs decor significantly less than the warm boho vibe downstairs. I couldn't decide whether I felt relieved or cheated by that. If there had been more of him, or of her, here, she'd already done the heavy lifting of scrubbing it clear. On Wednesday, I photographed the furniture and posted it on Craigslist. On Thursday, I packed the extra bedding, board games, and wrapping paper into boxes for Goodwill. On Friday, I stripped all the bedding and the towels from the racks in the second upstairs bathroom and carried them down to the laundry closet on the first floor, dumping them into the washer before sitting down to write. The mist had finally burned off, and the house was hot and sticky once again, so I'd opened the windows and doors and turned on all the fans. I'd gotten glimpses of Gus over the last 3 days, but they'd been few. As far as I could tell, he moved around while drafting. If he was working at the kitchen table in the morning, he was never there by the time I poured my second cup of coffee. If he was nowhere to be seen all day, he'd appear suddenly on the deck at night, writing with only the light of his laptop and the swarm of moths batting around it. Whenever I spotted him, I instantly lost focus. It was too fun imagining what he could be writing, brainstorming the possibilities. I was praying for vampires. On Friday afternoon, we lined up for the first time, sitting at our tables in front of our matching windows. He sat at his kitchen table facing my house. I sat at my kitchen table facing his. When we realized this, he lifted his bottle of beer the same way he'd mock toasted with his coffee mug. I lifted my water glass. Both windows were open. We could have talked, but we would have had to scream. Instead, Gus smiled and picked up the highlighter and notebook beside him. He scribbled on it for a second, then held the notebook up so I could read it. "Life is meaningless, January. Gaze into the abyss." I suppressed a laugh, then fished a Sharpie out of my backpack, dragged my own notebook toward me, and flipped to a blank page. In large, square letters, I wrote, "This reminds me of that Taylor Swift video." His smile leapt up his face. He shook his head, then went back to writing. Neither of us said another word, and neither of us relocated either. Not until he knocked on my front door for our first research outing, a steel travel mug in each hand. He gave my dress, the same itchy black thing I'd worn to book club, and boots, one slow up and down, then shook his head. "That will not work." "I look great," I fired back.
"Agreed. If we were going to see the American Ballet Theater, you'd be perfect. But I'm telling you, January, that will not work for tonight." "It's going to be a late night," Gus warned.
We were in his car, heading north along the lake, the sun slung low in the sky, its last feverish rays painting everything to look like backlit cotton candy. When I'd demanded he pick out my new outfit and save me the trouble, I'd expected him to be uncomfortable. Instead, he followed me into the downstairs guest room, looked at the handful of things hanging in the closet, and picked out the same denim shorts I'd worn to Pete's bookstore and my Carly Simon t-shirt. And with that, we'd set off. "As long as you don't make me listen to you sing Everybody Hurts twice in a row," I said, "I think I can deal with a late night." His smile was faint. It made his eyelids sink heavily.
"Don't worry. That was a special occasion I let a friend talk me into. Won't happen again."
He was tapping restlessly against the steering wheel as we pulled up to a red light, and my eyes slid down the veins in his forearms, up along the back of his bicep to where it met his sleeve. Jacques had been handsome like an underwear model, perfectly toned with a winning smile and golden brown hair that fell the same exact way every day.
But it was all of Gus's minor imperfections, his scars and ridges, crooked lines and sharp edges, and how they added up that had always made it hard for me to stop looking at him and made me want to see more. He leaned forward to mess with the temperature controls, his eyes flicking toward me. I jerked my gaze out the window, trying to clear my mind before he could read it.
"Do you want to be surprised?"
he asked. My heart seemed to trip over its next beat.
"What?" "About where we're going."
I relaxed. Surprised by something disturbing enough that you think it belongs in a book. No thanks.
"Probably wise," he agreed. "We're going to interview a woman whose sister was in a suicide cult."
"You're kidding." He shook his head. "Oh my God," I said through a shock of laughter. All at once, the tension I'd imagined dissipated. "Gus, are you writing a rom-com about a suicide cult?" He rolled his eyes.
"I scheduled this interview before our bet. Besides, the point of this outing is helping you learn to write literary fiction."
"Well, either way, you weren't kidding about staring into the abyss," I said. "So the point of this lesson is basically, everything sucks, now get to work writing about it?" Gus smirked.
"No, smartass. The points of this lesson are character and detail."
I faux gasped. "You're never going to believe this crazy coincidence, but we have those in women's fiction too."
"You know, you're the one who initiated this whole lesson plan element of the deal," Gus said. "If you're going to make fun of me the whole time, I'm happy to drop you off at the nearest suburban comedy club open mic and pick you up on the way back."
"Okay, okay." I waved him on. "Character and detail, you were saying." Gus shrugged.
"I like writing about outlandish scenarios. Characters and events that seem too absurd to be real, but still work. Having specificity helps make the unbelievable believable. So I do a lot of interviews. It's interesting what people remember about a situation. Like, if I'm going to write a cult leading zealot who believes he's an alien consciousness reincarnated as every great world leader for centuries, I also need to know what kind of shoes he wears and what he eats for breakfast."
"But do you really?" I teased. "Are the readers honestly begging for that?" He laughed.
"You know, maybe the reason you haven't been able to finish your book is that you keep asking what someone else wants to read instead of what you want to write."
I crossed my arms, bristling. "So tell me, Gus, how are you going to put a romantic spin on your suicide cult book?" His head tilted against the headrest, his knife-edged cheekbones casting shadows down his face. He scratched his jaw.
"First of all, when did I say this interview was for my rom-com? I could just as easily set aside all my notes from this until I win our bet, then get back to work on my next official novel."
"And is that what you're doing?" I asked.
"I don't know yet," he admitted. "Trying to figure out if I can combine the ideas."
"Maybe," I said doubtfully. "Tell me the specifics. I'll see if I can help."
"Okay, so..."
He adjusted his grip on the steering wheel.
"The original premise was basically that this journalist finds out his high school sweetheart, a former drug addict, has joined a cult, so he decides to infiltrate it and take it down. But while he's there, he starts moving up through the ranks really quickly, like way past the woman he went there to save. And as he does, he starts seeing all this stuff, this proof that the leader's right about everything. Eventually, the girl was going to get scared and try to back out, try to talk him into leaving with her."
"So I'm guessing," I said, "they leave, honeymoon in Paris, and settle down in a small villa in the south of France. Probably become winemakers."
"He was going to murder her," Gus said flatly. "To save her soul. I hadn't decided if that was going to be what finally brought the cult down, got all the leaders arrested and everything, or if he was going to become the new prophet. I liked the first option because it feels more like a closed loop. He wants to get her out of the cult, he does. He wants to bring the cult down, he does. But the second one feels more cyclical in a way. Like every damaged person with a hero complex, could end up doing exactly what the original leader of the cult does. I don't know. Maybe I'd have a young man or woman with a drug habit show up at the very end.
Cute, I said.
Exactly what I was going for, he answered.
So, any ideas for the not terrible version of this book?
I mean, I liked that South of France pitch. That shit's fire.
Glad you see things my way.
Anyway, he said, I'll figure it out. A cult rom-com does sound like a thing. What about you? What's your book?
I pretended to puke in my lap.
Cute,
he echoed, flashing me a grin. Speaking of fire, sometimes his eyes seemed to be reflecting it, even though there wasn't any. The car was nearly pitch black, for God's sake. His eyes shouldn't be allowed, physically or morally, to glint like that. His pupils were disrespectful to the laws of nature. My skin started burning under them. I have no idea what my book was, I said when he finally looked back to the road, and little idea what it is. I think it's about a girl. He waited for me to go on for a few seconds, then said,
Wow.
I know. There was more. There was the father she adored. There was his mistress and his beach house in the town he grew up in, and his wife's radiation appointments. But even if things between Gus Everett and me had warmed, the fault of his eyes, I wasn't ready for the follow-up questions this conversation might yield. Why did you move here anyway? I asked after a lengthy silence. Gus shifted in his seat. Clearly, there was plenty he didn't want to talk to me about either.
For the book, he said. I read about this cult here in the 90s. It had this big compound in the woods before it got busted. There was all kinds of illegal shit going on there. I've been here about 5 years, interviewing people and researching and all that.
Seriously? You've been working on this for 5 years? He glanced my way.
It's research heavy. And for part of that time, I was finishing up my second book and touring for that and everything. It wasn't like 5 uninterrupted years at a typewriter with a single empty water bottle to pee in.
Your doctor will be relieved to hear that. We drove in taut silence for a while before Gus rolled down his window, which gave me permission to roll mine down. The warm whip of the air against the open windows dissolved any discomfort from the silence we'd fallen into. We could have just been 2 strangers on the same beach or bus or ferry. As we drove, the sun vanished inch by inch. Eventually, Gus fiddled with the radio, stopping to crank up an oldies station playing Paul Simon.
I love this song, he told me over the wind cycloning through the car.
Really? I said, surprised. I figured you'd make me listen to Elliott Smith or Johnny Cash's cover of Hurt the whole way. Gus rolled his eyes, but he was smiling.
And I figured you'd bring a Mariah Carey playlist with you.
Damn, I wish I'd thought of that. His gruff laugh was mostly lost in the wind, but I heard enough of it to make my cheeks go warm. It was 2 hours before we got off the highway, and then another 30 minutes of ice-damaged back roads, lit only by the car's brights and the stars overhead. Finally, we pulled from the winding road through the woods into the gravel lot of a bar with a corrugated tin roof. Its glowing marquee read, The Bywater. Aside from a few motorcycles and a junker of a Toyota pickup, the lot was empty, but the windows, illuminated by glowing Budweiser and Miller signs, revealed a dense crowd inside. Be honest, I said. Did you bring me here to murder me? Gus turned off the car and rolled up the windows.
Please, we drove 3 hours. I've got a perfectly good murder spot back in North Bear Shores.
Are all your interviews at spooky dive bars in the forest? I asked.
He shrugged. Only the good ones.
We climbed out of the car. Without the 50-mile-per-hour wind, it was hot and sticky out, every few feet punctuated by a new cloud of mosquitoes or fireflies. I thought maybe I could hear the water, the bar's name referred to, somewhere in the woods behind it. Not the lake itself, I didn't think. A creek, probably.
I always felt a bit anxious going to neighborhood spots like this when I wasn't a part of the neighborhood, but Gus appeared to be at ease, and hardly anyone looked up from their beer or pool tables or trysts against the wall beside the old-school jukebox. It was a place full of camo hats and tank tops and Carhartt jackets. I was extremely grateful Gus had encouraged me to change my outfit. "Who are we meeting?" I asked, sticking close to him as he surveyed the crowd. He tipped his chin toward a lone woman at a high top near the back. Grace was in her mid-50s and had the rounded shoulders of someone who'd spent a lot of time sitting, but not necessarily relaxed, which made sense. She was a truck driver with 4 sons in high school and no romantic partner to lean on.
"Not that that matters," she said, taking a sip from her Heineken. "We're not here to talk about that. You want to know about Hope."
Hope, her sister. Hope and Grace, twins from northern Michigan, not quite the Upper Peninsula, she'd already told us.
"We want to talk about whatever you think is relevant," Gus said.
She wanted to be sure it wasn't for a news story. Gus shook his head.
"It's a novel. None of the characters will have your names or look like you or be you. The cult won't be the same cult. This is to help us understand the characters. What makes someone join a cult? When you first noticed something off with Hope? That sort of thing."
Her eyes glanced off the door, then back to us, an uncertainty in her expression. I felt guilty. I knew she'd come here of her own volition, but this couldn't be easy, scraping the muck out of her heart and holding it out to a couple of strangers. "You don't have to tell us," I blurted, and I felt the full force of Gus's eyes cut to me, but I kept my focus on Grace, her watery eyes, slightly parted lips. "I know talking about it won't undo any of it, but not talking about it won't either, and if there's anything you need to say, you can. Even if it's just your favorite thing about her, you can say it." Her eyes sharpened into slivers of sapphire, and her mouth tightened into a knot. For a second, she was stock still and somber, a Midwestern Madonna in a stone pietà, some sacred memory cradled in her lap where we couldn't quite see it. "Her laugh," she said finally. "She snorted when she laughed." The corner of my mouth inched up, but a new heaviness settled across my chest. "I love when people do that," I admitted. "My best friend does it. I always feel like she's drowning in life, in a good way, like it's rushing up her nose, you know?" A soft, wispy smile formed on Grace's thin lips. "A good way," she said quietly. Then her smile quivered sadly, and she scratched her sunburned chin, her sloped shoulders rising as she set her forearms on the table. She cleared her throat. "I didn't," she said thickly. "No, anything was off. That's what you wanted to know?" Her eyes glossed, and she shook her head once. "I had no idea until she was already gone." Gus's head tilted.
"How is that possible?"
"Because." Tears were rushing into her eyes even as she shrugged. "She was still laughing." We were silent for most of the drive home. Windows up, radio off, eyes on the road. Gus, I imagined, was mentally sorting the information he'd gotten from Grace. I was lost in thoughts about my dad. I could so easily see myself avoiding the questions I had about him until I was Grace's age, until Sonia was gone, and Mom too, and there was no one left to give me answers even if I wanted them. I wasn't prepared to spend my life avoiding any thought of the man who'd raised me, feeling sick whenever I remembered the envelope in the box atop the fridge. But I was also tired of the pain inside my ribcage, the weight pressing on my clavicles and anxious sweat that cropped up whenever I considered the truth for too long. I closed my eyes and pressed back into the headrest as the memory surged forward. I tried to fight it off, but I was too tired, so there it was. The crocheted shawl, the look on Mom's face, the key in my palm. God, I didn't want to go back to that house. The car stopped, and my eyes snapped open.
Sorry, Gus stammered.
He'd slammed the brakes to avoid plowing into a tractor at a dark four-way stop.
Wasn't paying attention.
Lost in that beautiful brain of yours? I teased, but it came out flat, and if Gus heard, he gave no indication. The more animated corner of his mouth was twisted firmly down.
You okay?
He asked. Yeah. He was quiet for another beat.
That was pretty intense. If you want to talk about it.
I thought back to Grace's story. She'd thought Hope was doing better than ever when she first fell in with her new crowd. She'd gotten off heroin, for one thing, a nearly insurmountable challenge.
I remember her skin looked better, Grace had said. And her eyes. I don't quite know what about them, but they were different too. I thought I had my sister back. 4 months later, she was dead.
She'd died by accident, internal bleeding from punishments. The rest of the trailer compound that was New Eden had gone up in flames as the FBI investigation was closing in. Everything Grace had told us was probably great for Gus's original plotline. It didn't leave a lot of room for meet-cutes and happily ever afters, but that was sort of the point. Tonight's research had been for me, to take my brain down the trails that led to the kind of book I was supposed to be writing. I couldn't understand how people did this, how Gus could bear to follow such dark paths just for the sake of a story, how he could keep asking questions when all I'd wanted all night was to grab Grace and hold her tight, apologize for what the world had taken from her, find some way, any way, to make the loss 1 ounce lighter.
Have to stop for gas,
Gus said, and pulled off the highway to a deserted Shell station. There was nothing but parched fields for miles in every direction. I got out of the car to stretch my legs while Gus pumped the gas. Night had cooled the air, but not much. This one of your murder spots? I asked, walking around the car to him.
I refuse to answer that on the grounds that you might try to take it from me.
Solid grounds, I answered. After a moment, I couldn't hold the question in any longer. Doesn't it bother you, having to live in someone else's tragedy? 5 years, that's a long time to put yourself in that place. Gus tucked the nozzle back into the pump, all his focus on twisting the gas cap closed.
Everybody's got shit, January. Sometimes thinking about someone else's is almost a relief.
Okay, fine, I said. Let me have it. Gus's eyebrows lifted and his sexy, evil mouth went slack.
What?
I folded my arms and pressed my hip into the driver's side door. I was tired of being the most delicate person in the room, the girl drunk on purse wine, the one trying not to tremble as someone else poured their pain out on a high top in a crummy bar. Let's hear this mysterious shit of yours, see if it gives me an effective break from mine. And now Grace's, which weighed just as heavily on my chest. Gus's liquidy dark eyes slid down my face.
Nah,
he said finally, and moved toward the door, but I stayed leaning against it.
You're in my way, he said.
Am I? He reached for the door handle, and I slid sideways to block it. His hand connected with my waist instead, and a spark of heat shot through me.
Even more in my way,
he said, in a low voice that made it sound more like, I dare you to stay there. My cheeks itched. His hand was still hanging against my hip, like he'd forgotten it was there, but his finger twitched, and I knew he hadn't. You just took me on the world's most depressing date, I said. The least you could do is tell me a single thing about yourself and why all this New Eden stuff matters to you. His brow lifted in amusement, and his eyes flickered in that bonfire-lit way.
Wasn't a date.
Somehow, he managed to make it sound filthy. Right, you don't date, I said. Why is that? Part of your dark, mysterious past?
His sexy, evil mouth tightened.
What do I get?
He stepped a little closer, and I became hyper-aware of every molecule of space between us. I hadn't been this close to a man since Jacques. Jacques had smelled like high-end cologne by commodity. Gus smelled smoky and sweet, like Nag Champa incense mixed with a salty beach. Jacques had blue eyes that twinkled over me like a summer breeze through chimes. Gus's dark gaze bored into me like a corkscrew. What do I get? Lively conversation? My voice came out unfamiliarly low. He gave a slight shake of his head.
Tell me why you moved here, and I'll tell you one thing about my dark, mysterious past.
I considered the offer. The reward, I decided, was worth the cost. My dad died. He left me his beach house. The truth, if not all of it. For the second time, an unfamiliar expression fluttered, sympathy, disappointment maybe, across his face too fast for me to parse out its meaning. Now your turn, I prompted.
Fine,
he said, voice scratchy.
One thing.
I nodded. Gus leaned in toward me and dropped his mouth beside my ear conspiratorially, his hot breath pulling goosebumps up the side of my neck. His eyes flashed sideways across my face, and his other hand touched my hips so lightly it could have been a breeze. The heat in my hips spread toward my center, curling around my thighs like kudzu. It was crazy that I remembered that night in college so vividly that I knew he'd touched me just like this. That first touch when we met on the dance floor, feather light and melting point hot, careful, intentional. I realized I was holding my breath, and when I forced myself to breathe, the rise and fall of my chest was ridiculous, the stuff of Regency-era erotica. How was he doing this to me? Again? After the night we'd had tonight, this feeling, this hunger in me shouldn't have been possible. After the year I'd had, I hadn't thought it was anymore.
I lied, he whispered against my ear. I have read your books.
His hands tightened on my waist, and he spun me away from the car, opened the door, and got in, leaving me gasping at the sudden cold of the parking lot. Chapter 11. The Not Date. I spent far too much of my Saturday trying to choose a perfect destination for Gus's first adventure in romance. Even though I'd been suffering from chronic writer's block, I was still an expert in my field, and my list of possible settings for his introduction to meet-cutes and happily ever afters was endless. I'd pounded out another 1,000 words first thing in the morning, but since then I'd been pacing and Googling, trying to choose the perfect place. When I still couldn't make up my mind, I'd driven myself to the farmer's market in town and walked the sunny aisle between the stands, searching for inspiration. I picked through buckets of cut flowers, longing for the days when I could afford a bundle of daisies for the kitchen, calla lilies for the nightstand in the bedroom. Of course, that had been back when Jacques and I were sharing an apartment. When you were renting in New York by yourself, there wasn't much money for things that smelled good for a week, then died in front of you. At the booth of a local farm, I filled my bag with plump tomatoes, orange and red, along with some basil and mint, cucumbers, and a head of fresh butter lettuce. If I couldn't pick something to do with Gus tonight, maybe we'd cook dinner. My stomach grumbled at the thought of a good meal. I wasn't big on cooking myself. It took too much time, I never felt like I had. But there was definitely something romantic about pouring 2 glasses of red wine and moving around a clean kitchen, chopping and rinsing, stirring and sampling tastes from a wooden spoon. Jacques had loved to cook. I could follow a recipe, okay, but he preferred a more intuitive cook-all-night approach, and kitchen intuition and food patience were both things I sorely lacked. I paid for my veggies and pushed my sunglasses up as I entered the enclosed part of the market in search of some chicken or steak and fell back into brainstorming. Characters could fall in love anywhere, an airport or auto body shop or hospital, but for an anti-romantic, it would probably take something more obvious than that to get the ideas going. For me, the best usually came from the unexpected, from mistakes and mishaps. It didn't take inspiration to dredge up a list of plot points, but to find that moment, the perfect moment that defined a book, that made it come alive as something greater than the sum of its words, that required an alchemy you couldn't fake. The last year of my life had proven that. I could plot all day, but it didn't matter if I didn't fall into the story head first, if the story itself didn't spin like a cyclone, pulling me wholly into itself. That was what I'd always loved about reading, what had driven me to write in the first place. That feeling that a new world was being spun like a spiderweb around you, and you couldn't move until the whole thing had revealed itself to you. While the interview with Grace hadn't given me any of those all-consuming tornadoes of inspiration, I had awoken with a glimmer of it. There were stories that deserved to be told, ones I'd never considered, and I felt a spark of excitement at the thought that maybe I could tell one of them and like doing it. I wanted to give Gus that feeling too. I wanted him to wake up tomorrow itching to write. Proving how difficult it was to write a rom-com was one thing, and I was confident Gus would see that. But getting him to understand what I loved about the genre, that reading and writing it was nearly as all-consuming and transformative as actually falling in love, would be a different challenge entirely. I was too distracted to write when I got home, so I put myself to better use. I twisted my hair into a topknot, put on shorts and a Todd Rundgren tank top, and went to the guest bathroom on the second floor with trash bags and boxes. Dad, or that woman, had kept the closet stocked with towels and backup toiletries, which I piled into donation boxes and carried to the foyer one at a time. On my third trip, I stopped before the kitchen window facing into Gus's house. He was sitting at the table, holding an oversized note up for me to see, like he'd been waiting. I balanced the box against the table and swiped my forearm up my temple to catch the sweat beating there as I read, "January, January, wherefore art thou January?" The message was ironic. The butterflies in my chest were not. I pushed the box onto the table and grabbed my notebook, scribbling in it. I held the note up. "New phone, who dis?" Gus laughed, then turned back to his computer. I grabbed the box and carried it out to the Kia, then went back for the rest. The humidity of the last few days had let up again, leaving nothing but breezy warmth behind. When I'd finished loading the car, I poured myself a glass of rosé and sat on the deck. The sky was bright blue, an occasional fluffy cumulus cloud drifting lazily past, and the sunlight painted the rustling treetops a pale green. If I closed my eyes, shutting myself off from what I could see, I could hear squeals of laughter down by the water. At home, Mom and Dad's yard had backed up to another family's, one with three young kids. As soon as they moved in, Dad had planted a grove of evergreens along the fence to create some privacy, but he'd always loved that on late summer nights, as we sat around the fire pit, we'd hear the screams and giggles of the kids playing tag or jumping on the trampoline, or lying in a tent behind their house. Dad loved his space, but he also always said he liked to be reminded that there were other people out there, living their lives, people who didn't know him or care to. "I know feeling small gets to some people," he had once told me, "but I kind of like it. Takes the pressure off when you're just one life of 6 billion at any given moment. And when you're going through something hard," at the time, Mom was doing chemo, "it's nice to know you're not even close to the only one." I'd felt the opposite. I was harboring a private heartbreak about the universe, about Mom's body betraying her again, about the life I'd dreamed of dissipating like mist. I'd watched my U of M classmates over Facebook as they went on to grad school and mysteriously funded international travel. I'd watched them post doting Mother's Day tributes from far corners of the world. I'd listened to the kids who lived behind my parents' house shriek and giggle as they played ghost in the graveyard.
and I'd felt secretly heartbroken that the world could do this to us again. And even worse, because I knew saying any of that would only make things harder for Mom. And then she'd kicked it the second time, and I'd been so grateful, more relieved than I knew a person could feel. Our life was back on track, the three of us stronger than ever. Nothing could tear us apart ever again, I was sure. But still, I was mourning those years lost to doctor visits and shed hair, and Mom, the doer, lying sick on the couch. Those feelings didn't fit with our beautiful post-cancer life, I knew. They added nothing helpful or good, so I tamped them down once more. When I found out about Sonia, they'd all sprung out, fermented into anger over time, like an overzealous jack-in-the-box pointed straight at Dad. Question. I looked up and found Gus leaning against the railing on his deck. His gray t-shirt was as rumpled as everything else I'd seen him wear. His clothes very likely never made it from the hamper to drawers, assuming they made it to the laundry in the first place, but the muss of his hair also suggested he could have just rolled out of a nap. I went to stand against the railing on my side of the 10-foot divide. I hope it's about the meaning of life. That or which book is first in the Bridget Jones series.
That, definitely, he said. And also, do I need to wear a tuxedo tonight?
I fought a smile. I would pay $100 to see what a tuxedo under your laundry regimen looks like. And I'm extremely broke, so that says a lot. He rolled his eyes.
I like to think of it as my laundry democracy.
See, if you let something inanimate vote on whether it wants to be washed, it's not going to answer.
January, are you taking me to a reenactment of the Beauty and the Beast ball or not? I'm trying to plan.
I studied him. Okay, I'll answer that question, but on the condition that you tell me, honestly, do you own a tuxedo? He stared back. After a long pause, he sighed and leaned into the railing. The sun had started to set, and the flexed veins and muscles in his lean arms cast shadows along his skin.
Fine. Yes, I own a tuxedo.
I erupted into laughter. Seriously? Are you a secret Kennedy? No one owns a tuxedo.
I agreed to answer one question. Now tell me what to wear.
Considering I've only seen you in almost imperceptibly different variations of one outfit, you can safely assume I wouldn't plan anything requiring a tuxedo. I mean, until now, when I found out you owned a tuxedo, now all bets are off. But for tonight, your grumpy bartender costume should do. He shook his head and straightened up.
Phenomenal, he said,
and went inside. In that moment, I knew exactly where I was going to take Gus Everett.
Wow, Gus said.
The carnival I'd found 8 miles from our street was in a Big Lots parking lot, and it fit there a bit too easily.
I just counted the rides, Gus said. 7.
I'm really proud of you for getting that high, I teased. Maybe next time, see if you can aim for 10.
I wish I were high, Gus grumbled.
It's perfect, I replied.
For what? He said.
Duh, I said. Falling in love. A laugh barked out of Gus, and again, I was a little too proud of myself for my own liking. Come on. I felt a pang of regret as I handed over my credit card at the ticket booth in exchange for our all-you-can-ride bracelets, but was relieved when Gus interrupted to insist on buying his own. That was one of many horrible parts of being broke. Having to think about whether you could afford to share sucked. That wasn't very romantic of me, I guess, I said as we wandered into the throng of bodies clustered around a milk can toss.
Well, lucky for you, that is pretty much my exact definition of romance.
He pointed to the teal row of porta-potties at the edge of the lot. A teenage boy with his hat turned backward was gripping his stomach and shifting between his feet as he waited for one of the toilets to open up, while the couple beside him hardcore made out. Gus, I said flatly, that couple is so into each other, they're making out a yard away from a literal row of shit piles. That juxtaposition is basically the entire rom-com lesson for the night. It really does nothing to your icy heart.
Heart? No, Stomach, a little. I'm getting sympathy diarrhea for their friend. Can you imagine having such a bad time with your friends that a porta potty becomes a beacon of hope? A bedrock, a place to rest your weary head. We're definitely looking at a future existentialist, maybe even a coldly horny novelist.
I rolled my eyes. That guy's night was pretty much my entire high school and much of college experience, and somehow I survived, tender human heart intact.
Bullshit, Gus cried.
Meaning?
I knew you in college, January.
That seems like the biggest in a series of vast exaggerations you've made tonight.
Fine, I knew of you, he said. The point is, you weren't the diarrhea-having third wheel. You dated plenty. Marco, right? That guy from our Fiction 400 workshop. And weren't you with that pre-med golden boy? The one who was addicted to studying abroad and tutoring disadvantaged youth and, like, rock-climbing shirtless?
I snorted. Sounds like you were more in love with him than I was. Something sharp and appraising flashed over Gus's eyes.
But you were in love with him.
Of course I was. I'd met him during an impromptu snowball fight on campus. I couldn't imagine anything more romantic than that moment when he'd pulled me up from the snowdrift I'd fallen into, his blue eyes sparkling, and offered his dry hat to replace my snow-soaked one. It took all of 10 minutes as he walked me home for me to determine that he was the most interesting person I'd ever met. He was working on getting his pilot's license and had wanted to work in the ER ever since he'd lost a cousin in a car accident as a kid. He'd done semesters in Brazil, Morocco, and France, Paris, where his paternal grandparents lived, and he'd also backpacked a significant portion of the Camino de Santiago by himself. When I told him I'd never been out of the country, he immediately suggested a spontaneous road trip to Canada. I thought he was kidding, basically, until we pulled up to the duty-free shop on the far side of the border around midnight.
There, he said with his model grin, all shiny and guileless. Next, we need to get you somewhere they'll actually stamp your passport.
That whole night had taken on a hazy, soft-focus quality like we were only dreaming it. Looking back, I thought we sort of had been. Him pretending to be endlessly interesting, me pretending to be spontaneous and carefree as usual. Outwardly, we were so different, but when it came down to it, we both wanted the same thing. A life cast in a magical glow, every moment bigger and brighter and tastier than the last. For the next 6 years, we were intent on glowing for each other. I tucked the memories away. I was never with Marco, I answered Gus. I went to one party with him, and he left with someone else. Thanks for reminding me. Gus's laugh turned into an exaggerated, pitying, aww. It's fine, I persevered. Gus's head cocked, his eyes digging at mine like shovels.
And Golden Boy?
We were together, I admitted. I'd thought I was going to marry him. And then Dad had died and everything had changed. We'd survived a lot together with Mom's illness, but I'd always held things together, found ways to shut off the worrying and have fun with him. But this was different. Jacques didn't know what to do with this version of me, who stayed in bed and couldn't write or read without coming apart, who slugged around at home letting laundry pile up and ugliness seep into our dreamy apartment, who never wanted to throw parties or walk the Brooklyn Bridge at sunset or book a last-minute getaway to Joshua Tree. Again and again, he told me I wasn't myself. But he was wrong. I was the same me I'd always been. I'd just stopped trying to glow in the dark for him or anyone else. It was our beautiful life together, amazing vacations and grand gestures and freshly cut flowers and handmade vases that had held us together for so long. It wasn't that I couldn't get enough of him, or that he was the best man I'd ever known. I'd thought that was my dad, but now it was the dad from my favorite 2000s teen drama, Veronica Mars. Or that he was my favorite person, that was Shoddy. Or because he made me laugh so hard I wept. He laughed easily, but rarely joked. Or that when something bad happened, he was the first person I wanted to call. He wasn't. It was that we met at the same age my parents had,
that the snowball fight and impromptu road trip had felt like fate, that my mother adored him. He fit so perfectly into the love story I'd imagined for myself that I mistook him for the love of my life. Breaking up still sucked in every conceivable way, but once the initial pain wore off, memories from our relationship started to seem like just another story I'd read. I hated thinking about it. Not because I missed him, but because I felt bad for wasting so much of his time and mine trying to be his dream girl. "We were together," I repeated. "Until last year."
"Wow,"
Gus laughed awkwardly.
"That's a long time. I'm really regretting making fun of his shirtless rock climbing now."
"It's okay," I said, shrugging. He dumped me in a hot tub. Outside a cabin in the Catskills, 3 days before our trip with his family was scheduled to end. Spontaneity wasn't always as sexy as it was cracked up to be.
"You're just not yourself anymore," he'd told me. "We don't work like this, January."
We left the next morning, and on the drive back to New York, Jacques had told me he'd call his parents when we got back to let them know the news.
"Mom's going to cry," he said. "So is Brigitte."
Even in that moment, I was possibly more devastated to lose Jacques' parents and sister, a feisty high schooler with impeccable 1970s style, than Jacques himself.
"A hot tub?"
Gus echoed.
"Damn. Honestly, that guy was always so self-impressed, I doubt he could even see you through the glare off his own glistening body."
I cracked a smile. "I'm sure that was it."
"Hey,"
Gus said.
"Hey, what?"
He tipped his head toward a cotton candy stand.
"I think we should eat that."
"And here it finally is," I said.
"What?"
Gus asked. "The second thing we agree on." Gus paid for the cotton candy, and I didn't argue.
"No, that's fine," he teased when I said nothing. "You can just owe me. You can just pay me back whenever."
"How much was it?" I asked, tearing off an enormous piece and lowering it dramatically into my mouth.
$3, but it's fine. Just Venmo me the $1.50 later."
"Are you sure that's not too much trouble?" I said. "I'm happy to go get a cashier's check."
"Do you know where the closest Western Union is?" he said. "You could probably wire it."
"What sort of interest were you thinking?" I asked.
"You can just give me $3 when I take you home, and then, if I ever find out I need an organ, we can circle back."
"Sure, sure," I agreed. "Let's just put a pin in this."
"Yeah, we should probably loop in our lawyers anyway."
"Good point," I said. "Until then, what do you want to ride?"
"Ride?"
Gus said.
"Absolutely nothing here."
"Fine," I said. "What are you willing to ride?" We'd been walking, talking, and eating at an alarming rate, and Gus stopped suddenly, offering me the final clump of cotton candy.
"That,"
he said while I was eating, and pointed at a pathetically small carousel.